Welcome back to Wednesday Night Bible Study. I'm Richard Meservey, and we are studying the vision of Isaiah. I am sorry to say that the slides won't show on the stream. They are showing in person where you don't need them as much as you do maybe on the stream, but my apologies. We'll try to fix it up. You'll believe me if I tell you it worked an hour ago. There's a reason why I retired from the computer business, and I have no desire to go back, but apparently I don't have a choice. But we are in Isaiah. Quick review. The main theme that we've been looking at is the light over darkness, and Isaiah is going back and forth between the sin of the people of Israel and Judah and the judgment that is coming, and then he'll bounce back to the glorious light and hope of the coming salvation of God. We looked last week at Isaiah 9:6, which is a key verse in Isaiah. If you recall, in the midst of the darkness at the end of chapter 8, Isaiah says that the people then in the Galilee have seen a great light, and that light was a child born and a son given, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, that he would be the one that can plan and purpose the work of God. He has the wisdom to rule effectively according to God's law, as opposed to Ahaz that Isaiah is dealing with. And if there's any doubt that this will take place, that the coming one will come, he concludes by saying that the zeal of the Lord will perform it. It's going to happen, even though he wouldn't see it before he died, and it wouldn't take place for 700 years. But the passion of God for his own glory and for his people would accomplish it. Then in the rest of chapter 9 and the beginning of 10, he goes right back into darkness, and looks at all the reasons that the Lord is angry with his people and with the people of Assyria. And the whole section is tied together by that phrase that he repeats four times. For all this, all these bad things that are happening, for all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is still outstretched. And some of those things are the arrogance of Assyria in 10:5 through 19. He asks the question, shall the axe boast over the one that wields it? And Assyria is seen as a tool in the hand of God to bring judgment to his own people. And that axe the Lord wields, but Assyria thinks of himself as the all-powerful one. But he's not all-powerful, is he? He's a tool in the hand of God. We saw before, it said the Lord would whistle for him to come. You know, it's almost like, says a bee or a fly, but it's like whistling for a taxi or something, and he just comes and escorts you where he wants to go. And that's what Assyria is to the Lord. So they're full of pride, but they're just a tool in God's hand. And the Lord is doing his work to bring judgment to his people. And that's the strange thing, is that we expect him to judge his enemies, but his own people have turned away from him, and he brings judgment brings judgment to them. This later on, Isaiah will call his alien work, his strange work. It's foreign to him, and it's a strange thing that he does, but he will eventually bring restoration through them. So if you look at the end of verse 19 of chapter 10. The remnant of the trees of his forest will be so few that a child can write them down. That's, he's talking about the judgment on Assyria and how he will destroy them. But you've seen that word before, the word remnant. Now here, he's talking about the destruction of Assyria, and the remnant will be so small that a child will be able to count the number of trees in a forest that the Lord is destroying. But then in verse 20 in chapter 10, this is where we stopped. In verse 20 of chapter 10, Isaiah says, in that day, the remnant of Israel, right? So he jumps from the remnant of Assyria, which is next to nothing, to the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean on him who struck them, but will lean on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return. Destruction is decreed, overflowing with righteousness, for the Lord God of hosts will make a full end as decreed in the midst of the earth. So here he turns back to that theme of the remnant of Israel. And what does he say about that remnant? They'll return. Yeah, and that's important. Because he said before they would, you know, that there would be survivors. And then even if they go into exile, they would return. But here it's not just physical return, is it? They'll return. What did you say?
In 21 it says to the mighty God, but in 20 it says they will faithfully trust the Lord.
They will return to the mighty God, and it says they will lean on him who's on the Lord rather than on Assyria. Remember, Ahaz was tempted to bribe Assyria to protect him from Israel and Syria. And so here, their trust is not in the Lord. But the day will come, he says, when the remnant of Israel will return, but not just to the land. They will return to the mighty God, and they'll return to their trust in him. So they will lean on the true God. And it tells them, how will they lean on him?
In truth.
In truth, or in faithfulness. The very things that the whole nation didn't have, that Isaiah sees a day when their faith will be in him. And this is so important. Because, I mean, a lot today, they look at a physical return to Israel of ethnic Jews. But that's not enough. For restoration to take place, there has to be a turning to the true God. There has to be faith in him and trust in him. And that happens when they see the Messiah that Isaiah will be talking about in a minute. So the remnant will lean on him, they'll lean on him in truth, and they will return to the mighty God. Remember the name of one of his sons, She'er Yashub, a remnant shall return, will be fulfilled in him. Now, what does that remind you of when he talks about, in verse 22, for though your people Israel are as the sand of the sea. What does that remind you of?
God's promise to Abraham.
Yeah, what did he say?
His descendants would be like the sand of the sea or like the stars in the sky.
Yeah, go outside, you count the stars. If you can count them, that's how many your descendants will be. Or the number of grains in the sea, that's how many your remnant will be. But here he says, though the people of Israel are as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return. There will be a small portion of that innumerable number. And it's through that few that he will fulfill his covenant promise. And it says there, through this, destruction is decreed, overflowing righteousness, for the Lord will make a full end as decreed in the midst of all the earth. That the judgment will take place, but there will be those that will put their faith in the true God. Now, this theme is taken up by the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 9 through 11, where he contrasts ethnic Israel with Israel by faith. That there was always an Israel within Israel. And his view is that there were a number of the remnant in Israel that had true faith in the Lord. And he used the example of Elijah. Do you remember Elijah had the big showdown at the OK Corral with the prophets of Baal, and then he flees Jezebel and he goes to this cave. Do you remember what the Lord said to him in the cave?
I can't remember if it was 3,000 or 5,000, but a big number of prophets were, or priests were still faithful.
That were what?
Still faithful.
That we're still faithful. Yeah,
he was the only one.
Yeah, he said, what are you doing here? Well, you know, I'm no better than my fathers. I'm the only one left. And the Lord said, I have 7,000. Not three, not five, but do I hear seven? there are 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. And Paul says, that is the remnant by faith. That is the true Israel. The true Israel were not just ethnic descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but they had a true faith in the living God. And that's what Isaiah sees here, that ethnically there may be multitudes. There's a subset of the remnant that have a faith in him, and it's through them that the Lord will fulfill his covenant promises. And that multitude will be fulfilled as well. Because what we find is that God will include Gentiles in that number of Israel. That he compares it to a tree where you have these branches in this tree, and unbelieving Jews are broken off from the tree, and believing Gentiles are grafted in. So you have this people of God, the covenant promises of God, fulfilled in Jew and Gentile in one people. Ephesians is the same thing. He breaks down the middle wall of partition, and you Gentiles who were not part of Israel, were not in the covenant promises, were not in the nation, have been grafted into the one temple of God. And Isaiah, just with a little principle of this, just mentions it and goes on. Paul makes a big theological point about it. So anything else that we need to look at in that section before we move on? Any questions or comments? All right, so the Lord then goes on and says that not only will he restore this remnant, but he will bring destruction against their enemies. He'll break the yoke that binds them, and therefore they should not fear. He's going to bring complete deliverance and eventually cut down Assyria. Now, the end of the chapter 10 has a lot of cities. The Assyrians bragged about how I took this city, this city, this city, this city, but they couldn't take Jerusalem because the Lord was protecting that city. But again, at the end of the chapter, verse 34, He will cut down the thickets of the forest with an axe. Lebanon will fall by the majestic one. That the ones they're so afraid of, or the ones that they're trusting, will be destroyed. And then chapter 11 really is the climax of the whole first part of the book. Chapter 11 is the theme of the branch of the Lord, which we already saw. Remember back in chapter 4 that the stump of Israel, a growth would come out of it and bear fruit. And in that day, that branch would grow. And that branch refers to the remnant, but it also refers to the Messiah. And that's how Isaiah picks it up in chapter 11. So let's turn to chapter 11, and we'll spend more time here than chapter 10. But his, again, from darkness to light. Pay attention here. Ask yourself, you know, who is he talking about? What is this doing? What's important? So there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. I could stop right. So who's Jesse?
Father of David.
Thank you. It's like people are so intimidated. What's the worst that can happen if it's wrong? Yeah, the father of David. So here's like a second son of David. It's not even a descendant of David, but on par with David. And in fact, we'll see later, greater than David. But there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness shall be the belt of his loins. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. We could stop the study of Isaiah here. We see the glorious victory of the coming one. But what we don't have yet is how he gives his life to fulfill these things. But in here, we have the branch growing out of the stump that's cut down by the judgment of God. And it's divided into the coming king in 1 through 5, and the coming kingdom, 6 through 9, and the coming remnant, 10 through 16, which I didn't read. So, first of all, the coming king. What does it tell you about the one that he says, there shall come this king? What does he tell us about it?
The Spirit of the Lord rest upon him.
Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. Anything else?
Spirit of wisdom and understanding, counsel and might, knowledge and
Yeah, so a little details about what the Spirit of the Lord means. What else?
He'll be a righteous judge.
I'm sorry?
He'll be a righteous judge.
I mean, try to imagine you're living in Isaiah's day and you're dealing with Ahaz, right? It's no wisdom, no might, no strength, no righteousness. I mean, this is the hope of Israel for a true king that they're not seeing. But yeah, he'll judge righteously. Notice it says he will not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear. So how do you judge rightly if you don't hear and don't see?
You don't.
Yeah. Well, it says he will not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what he hears. And yet he's the righteous judge. It's all right.
He has discernment that just like when Samuel went to the house of Jesse to choose the king, he said that God doesn't see, he doesn't look at the outward.
Doesn't look at the outward, yeah. And so it reminds me of, in the law, it said, you know, somebody goes to court, do not take the face. Do not look and judge by the appearance. Right? It's based on the law of God, not this one's wealthy, that one's poor. And so here, it's not looking at the appearance. It's not hearing the deceptive lies in the stories and the alibi. He's judging according to the truth and according to God's word. What else did you notice in here? I should say, so first of all, 1 through 3, we see his person, who he is, what he's like. 3 through 5, his precepts of righteousness, justice, equity. In 6 through 9, what do you see? It's a peaceful kingdom. How is that described?
Dangerous things with peace, with calm.
Yeah, it's like these predators are living in peace with the prey, and even, you know, the old enemy of the serpent is there's no harm for the little child or the infant. Joined together in perfect peace. In 10 through 16, we'll see his calling of his people and gathering them, and then in chapter 12, we'll finish tonight with his praise. Yeah, Myron?
I think this is a prophetic utterance here, and it brought to my mind, I don't know if you're going to cover it, so I'm raising it. In Luke chapter 2, we read these words, seems almost a quote, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. And I think Luke is giving words of fulfillment to what was written here.
Yes, and I don't have that. But I have something else. That's better. So I'm just going to go through these. First of all, his person. Maybe I should ask. So I have the title of this slide, The Messiah, His Person. What does Messiah mean? So I'm thinking, I don't want to offend people by asking something that everybody knows. But all I hear is silence. What does Messiah mean?
least, I may be getting that mixed up with his name, you know, Yeshua. That's
yeah,
not the same.
So,
sorry, I got that wrong.
No, but that's what he does
right.
as a deliverer. But the Messiah means the anointed one. And it comes from texts like this. What does it say? The thing that's most noticeable about him is, first of all, you know, born from Jesse, he's the branch. But second, the qualifications is he is endowed with the Spirit of the Lord. The Messiah means the anointed one. That comes from the Hebrew. The Greek equivalent to that is what? Is Christ. Christos is anointed. So here you have the hope of Israel that Isaiah sees in the darkness of his time is one that comes anointed by the Spirit of God. Compare this to Ahaz, or even compare it to David, that here is one that is perfect in the anointing of God that is upon him in the Spirit. And that Spirit, he says, there shall come out of the shoot of Jesse a branch bearing fruit. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. It will come and rest upon this anointed one. And I can't help but think, John had said, I saw the dove, the Spirit of God coming and remaining on him. And there's a contrast here between the anointings in the Old Testament of prophet, priest, and king that could be temporary. But this one is permanent. And yeah, so he grows in wisdom and knowledge of the Lord and his stature. And he fulfills the duty that the king has. The character is that he delights in the Lord and he reverences him. And I just picked number of scriptures that could be cited. That here you have the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my feet until I make your footstools, your enemies a footstool. Or John 1:32, I saw the Spirit falling on him and remaining. In Matthew chapter 12, it says that the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled in this one, as the Lord said, behold, my servant whom I've chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is pleased, I'll put my Spirit on him and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. Now, then he goes into detail, and I should say Hebrews 5 talks about the delight of God to obey his Father and becoming perfect in his sufferings. But how does he describe this Spirit? He said that the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. And then he goes into detail of what that Spirit is. What does he say? There's three pairs. Wisdom and understanding.
Counsel and might.
Counsel and might.
Knowledge and fear.
Knowledge and fear of the Lord. And in the middle is the Spirit of the Lord. And you'll see this. If those of you that are in the Wesley class on Sunday mornings, you've been through the book of Revelation, did you notice the times he talks about the seven spirits of God, really the sevenfold Spirit of God, the fullness of the Spirit? And often in Revelation and other places, seven is as seen as a number of perfection or fulfillment. So here is the completeness, the fullness of the Spirit, whereas other prophet, priests, and king had a portion of the Spirit of God. This one has the complete and the complete package. And others point to the fact that the candelabra or the lampstand in the tabernacle, which represents the light of God for his people, the dwelling place of God in the tabernacle, was lit by this lampstand. It had seven flames on it. And these three pairs and the Lord in the center reveal the true perfect light of the world. And these wisdom and understanding is typically seen as judicial government, the very thing that King Ahaz was terrible at. Counsel and might is the strategy and the power to accomplish that strategy in the context of war and battle. That here, this one is wise to judge his people and strong to deliver them from their opponents. And then finally, the heart of the matter is the knowledge and the fear of the God. Again, the last thing that Ahaz could be known for is reverence for God. Remember, we saw in Kings how he had turned away from God, how he had built false altars and sacrificed his son. And he even went to Damascus and copied their altar to worship on. All the things that God said don't do, he did. But this one comes with the character of God. And these values of wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, knowledge, and reverence, these are the things that God reveals. And the people longed for a leader that would exemplify these things. And Isaiah says, this is the one that's coming. This is the one that's coming. This one, born out of the line of David, this one will be anointed with the Spirit, and the Spirit will rest upon him. He'll bring judgment on the earth. So in Isaiah 42, we'll get to it eventually. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom I delight. My soul delights, I have put my Spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the nations. That's fulfilled in the coming of Jesus. So anything comes to mind as you look at the aspects of the Spirit of God upon him? Or does it challenge you to look at your life in any particular way?
Verse 3, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord.
I think verse 3 is good. No. what do you thinking, Brent? Does something not seem right?
Well, I tried to find a commentary on it, but I couldn't find one in a couple minutes. But
so there's a few kinds of fear. And there's the abject terror of those that are in opposition to God and therefore face his judgment. And then there's the fear of reverence, of holy awe, of love and honor. And that's what it is here, that here this godly one is not afraid of judgment. He executes judgment, but in fact, he delights in the Lord and in the knowledge of the Lord and in the respect and honor of him. This is, we see this in Jesus as well, where he does what his Father sends him to do. He speaks what his Father speaks, and he submits to the Father's will in all things. Is that what you were thinking of, or where were you going? Anything else? Then in the end of 3 and on are his precepts. He decides disputes. He executes righteousness. He judges the poor, decides equity. He'll strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and the breath of his lips. He shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist and faithfulness the belt of his loins. So here he's coming as the ruler and the judge of all the earth, and his judgments are accurate. He is, some people call him the warrior king. He comes to defeat the enemies of God and the enemies of God's people, and he's dressed for battle. But he battles in righteousness and in faithfulness or truth. In 11:6-9, we looked at this before. Here you have the wolf, the lamb, the violent animals living in peace with the grazing animals. You have the children. So how would you summarize all of that? What is the hope here?
Many of those animals, if you look at the blessings of Jacob on his sons for the tribes, the tribes were represented. You look at their banners. Most of even the wild animals are represented in those banners. And at the time, many of them didn't get along. Many have been banished. So this is also could be that they're all going to come back and live together in peace.
Yeah. Tribes, and we'll see the same thing later on in this chapter of Israel and Judah no longer in jealousy and in enmity. But so what you're saying, and I think it's true, is that this peace among animals is symbolic of also peace among people. Right? And we saw this way back in chapter 2. Remember the vision Isaiah had? Of all the nations streaming or flowing up to Mount Zion to learn God's ways, to be taught by him, and how they would beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation would not learn war anymore and be opposed to other nations, but there would be worldwide peace. So here you have an environment that reveals worldwide peace, not just in the animal kingdom, but in the nations of men. And there's a security and a safety, right? You picture I just saw this on the stupid Facebook. It's a picture of this like huge, steep road that goes way down. And then it goes out into this road, out a bridge, right out into the ocean. And it goes way down and out. And at the top of it, there's this little boy standing on a skateboard. And the caption says, "Why boys need parents." Right? I mean, and I'm thinking, this is not going to end well. But here's a child sticking a hand in the where the snake is dwelling, without any fear, without any threat, without any danger. There's just life, abundant life. We live in a world that's broken, and we're so used to it because it's always been broken, as far as we know. But it wasn't always broken, was it? It was perfect, and it'll be perfect again. And that's the hope he has, that not just deliverance from Assyria, but far greater deliverance from sin, deliverance from death, deliverance from all evil. That's a hope worth hanging on to. And that's what Isaiah is saying. So there's peace and safety, harmony. This is Eden restored. This he calls in Isaiah 65, we'll get to sometime this decade, that he calls it a new heavens and a new earth. And we see the same thing in the New Testament, a new heavens and new earth where righteousness dwells. That this peace and security is impossible unless God overcomes sin and death and Satan. And that's the life here. There's no violence. And as he concludes in verse 9, they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. What is the holy mountain? You know this. We did this. This is Mount Zion. Right, this is the dwelling place of God, Mount Zion. And here, for Isaiah, Mount Zion is everything. It's not just a little mountain in the midst of all the mountains. It is, there will be, he said, there will be no hurt or destroying in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That the knowledge of the Lord that the Messiah delighted in verse 3 is now the experience of the entire earth. The earth is full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The mountain of God, the dwelling place of God, is complete and everywhere. We see the same thing in Revelation where it says, I saw the city of God coming down out of heaven like a bride dressed for her husband. And there was no temple in it, for the Lord and the Lamb are the temple. The worship of God was for the entire earth as it comes down. This is what Isaiah is seeing, that the earth is filled with the knowledge of the Lord and is fulfilled in the one that opened up the way for us to go into the knowledge and the knowledge of God. So Revelation 21:10, he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city of Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. That, you know, heaven is not our hope. Our hope is that earth becomes heaven. Heaven and earth, new, righteous, and in complete and total harmony. That's the hope of the Bible. And it'll be fulfilled in this one that's anointed by the Spirit. So something not clear, not right, or not useful. What comes to mind?
Whenever I see the word seed, I often add of people. Because often when they reference sea, they mean, so the water that washes over the sea is the living water. So Christ is saying that his living water is going to cover
yes.
all the people.
And if you'll hold that thought, if we get to chapter 12, we're going to come back to that, because that's exactly what Isaiah says. All right, then I didn't read it before, but in verse 10, the Messiah and his people. In that day, now we've seen that phrase how many times in Isaiah? It's like over and over and over again. But almost always when you read it, it was in that day, this is going to be judged, that's going to be judged, this, you know, it's almost always a bad thing. But in that day, when this Messiah comes and he establishes his kingdom, his new heavens and new earth, in that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, Of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place will be glorious. That here is one, stands as a signal. It's really a rallying cry or a flag, a banner to lead into battle. But it's not just for Israel, is it? Who is it for? In verse 10.
All the nations of the world.
For the nations. The nations. Drawn to the Messiah. And in that day, in verse 11, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant, again that word, the remnant, that remains of his people from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, from Shinar, Hamath, and from the coastlands of the sea, right? Worldwide, drawing the people that have been scattered to the Lord, in addition to the nations. Again, the nations and the ethnic Israel. And they will be, in unity, verse 12, he will raise a signal for the nations, and will assemble the banished of Israel, gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The jealousy of Ephraim shall depart, and those who harass Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not be jealous of Judah, Judah shall not harass Ephraim. But they shall swoop down on the shoulder of the Philistines in the west, and together they shall plunder the people of the east. They shall put out their hand against Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites shall obey them. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt, wave his hand over the river and with his scorching breath, and will strike it into seven channels. He'll lead the people across in sandals, and there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people, as there was for Israel when they come up out of the land of Egypt. This is the redemption of God, that he says, I wave my hand a second time, a second redemption, a new redemption, redeeming his people from all around the world, the people of God and the nations, drawing to him, walking on a highway from the nations of the world in order to make pilgrimage up to the Mount Zion and to give him the worship and praise that belongs to him. That they don't even have to worry about parting the sea, because he breaks it into seven channels they can walk through on sandals. That this is, you know, the judgment of God is not the end result. The judgment of God is to remove the things that separate us from him, that we might be made right and holy and enjoy eternal life in him. That's what he's doing. So when Isaiah sees darkness, it's temporary, but the light of God is eternal, and it is beckoning for people as a signal, and he brings the deliverance. And we see this fulfilled in Jesus, don't we? He overcomes the world, he overcomes the flesh, he overcomes the devil, he overcomes sin, and he overcomes death. Something in there, because I wanted to make sure we get to chapter 12. I heard a whisper. All right, so summary of chapter 11 and really 1 through 11 is this Messiah is our perfect hope. He promises a perfect king, a perfect kingdom, ruled in perfect righteousness. He even makes the sinful people righteous in him. It's a perfect environment of the new heavens and new earth. It's a perfect victory over sin and death and Satan. It's perfect harmony and unity and the destruction of all rivalries between Israel and Judah, between Israel, Judah, and the rest of the nations in harmony and unity. The knowledge of God in all the earth and all the people, knowing Him intimately and communing with Him, and perfect holiness, praise, and worship, which we see in chapter 12. All the utopian dreams that have come in human thinking are foolish and useless. The only way this can happen is through this Messiah, anointed by the Spirit of God, working the work of God in the world. And he notice he says, in that day. It is not evolution. It is the miraculous, supernatural work of God when He comes to complete His kingdom on earth. And there is no other hope. Everything else in Isaiah is darkness. This is light, and the light of the world. Anything else on chapter 11, or we'll quickly get to chapter 12, which teaches us how to respond to these things. All right, chapter 12. I mean, this is really, it's almost whiplash. You read this because all of a sudden, it doesn't seem like you're reading Isaiah anymore, you're reading a psalm. And it's actually a song of worship. And so this struck me as I was thinking this over, that, you know, oftentimes we look at these prophecies and they're detailed enough to confuse us, and sometimes they're harsh enough to upset us and cause fear and consternation, and we wonder how is all this going to take place. But Isaiah's response is worship and praise. The honor, the glory of God that's revealed inspires us to respond. And that's what he does in chapter 12. So in 12, you will say in that day, right? When you see this happen in that day, when the Lord completes His work, that I will give thanks to you, O Lord. For though you were angry with me, your anger turned away that you might comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. With joy, you will draw water from the wells of salvation. And you'll say in that day, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon His name. Make known His deeds among the peoples. Proclaim that His name is exalted. Sing praises to the Lord, for He has done gloriously. Let this be made known in all the earth. Shout, sing for joy, O inhabitants of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. We have seen that phrase, the Holy One of Israel, in Isaiah over and over and again. And it reminds us of that great vision he has. But it's not judgment. It's the Holy One revealing himself and receiving the praise that belongs to him. So what are some of the attitudes that he challenges us to have as we look at his prophecy? What kinds of things came out?
We should have a song of praise to the Lord.
A song of praise. What else? Trust in Him. We've got a song of praise. We've got trust.
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
No need for fear anymore. Comfort.
There's a confidence and comfort. joy.
We're to let everyone know how great and wonderful he is.
Yeah, there's a, it's not just an internal thing, it's expression out, isn't it? That praise and glory of God deserves to be broadcast. So he begins with, give thanks to the Lord. He's given us comfort. We'll see this in, after he goes through all first 39 chapters of judgments, in chapter 40 he begins, comfort ye my people. Now that's where this is all going. Trust in him. He is my salvation. And so he's the one that delivers us from evil and the one that conquers evil. That's our salvation, both the negative and the complete. And he's my strength and my song. He's become my salvation. With joy, he says, you will draw water from the wells of salvation. So if chapter 11 reminded us of the redemption of Exodus, right? But a new Exodus where he breaks the waters and brings his scattered people back. This reminds us of how God provided for them in the wilderness by giving them water to drink. And I always think of this, that in John chapter 7, it talks about the Feast of Jesus going to the Feast of Tabernacles. And as part of the Feast of Tabernacles, it's a week-long celebration. As part of it, they would go down to the Pool of Siloam, fill a golden censer with water, march it up Mount Zion to the temple, and pour it out before the Lord. And they would quote, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. On the last and great day of the feast, Jesus stands before the people. You know what he says. He said, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. For there's, and out of your belly will come rivers of living water. This is the joy that Isaiah sees, that is fulfilled in the one that brings living water to dry and parched people, living in desert wilderness, looking for life and finding it in all things that don't ultimately satisfy or complete. But here is living water, free to come and drink. And when they pour that out, they're declaring that the day would come when Isaiah's prophecy would be fulfilled. And Jesus is saying, that day is today. That day is right now. Come and drink. And be satisfied with living water that only he can provide. That's the fulfillment of Isaiah's hope. And then there's the exaltation of God. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Proclaim that his name is exalted. Lift him up in praise, for he has done gloriously. Let this be made known in all the earth. Shout and sing for joy, O inhabitant of Zion. For great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. Great in your midst. This is the fulfillment of what we saw in chapter 7. Remember he said, a son will be born. His name will be what? Emmanuel. God is with us. Isaiah lives in a day when God has turned his back on them because they turned their back on him. But the day will come when he dwells in the midst of his people, that they enjoy his presence. And I think of Jesus hanging on the cross, dying, carrying the world's sin, carrying our sin, my sin. And as he dies, the veil in the temple is split in half. The way into the holy place where that light shines, where that bread is feeding, and where God's glory is revealed. Inviting people just to come. Come into his presence. Come into him. And he dwells in our our midst. That's the hope of Isaiah. The light overcomes the darkness and fulfills that God dwells in the midst of his people. He is worthy of praise, isn't he? That we were dead in our sin. We were wandering in the desert. We had no hope, no God in the world, separated from the covenants of promise. And he's opened up the door for Gentile and Jew to come and enter into his presence. We ask, oh God, that your rivers of water would flow in our hearts, in our church, in our congregation, that, oh God, we would drink to our full and it would overflow into the world around us. Quench our hearts, oh God. Cause us to desire the deep, rich things of God, that we would come into your presence. You've opened the way for us, but we don't always take it. I ask for your forgiveness that I would be content with a superficial knowledge of you when you offer that I could know you deeply and fully. I thank you and praise you for this in Jesus' name. Amen. Anything else that you thought we should have talked about, but we skipped over?
Verse 2 and 3, when they use the word salvation, if you look in one of the, I got an Orthodox Jewish Bible I look at too. The word they use there, what I mentioned earlier, is Yeshua.
Yeah.
Which, it's only recently that I realized that Yeshua is the same as Joshua, which is the same as Jesus.
Yeah, and in fact, it's...
When we see the word salvation, and you were just saying Jesus, his name means salvation, is offering water. So it's something that, for whatever reason, I never had the connection that all those words are the same.
Yeah, and in fact, Isaiah as well means Yahweh is salvation. That his very name is actually the theme of the book and the theme of the whole Bible. Anyone else? And it's Neil, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know if we could have a group shout to the Lord or shout of joy.
Yes, we can. Actually, I have a song, but I need to close the stream first because I don't understand the copyright stuff and Jeff isn't here to do it. So God bless you. Glad you could be with us. I'm sorry we didn't have the screen. We'll have it fixed up next week, Lord willing. And I can give you the slides if you need them. God bless you. I'll see you next week.